I'm delighted now to welcome Jeremiah Clement. He is an energy efficiency consultant for Infrastructure Innovations. He's based in Chicago but is visiting Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you are working with something that I'd never heard of before. Maybe our listeners have, but it's called the triple bottom line model. What is that?
Triple bottom line model is a business model for businesses in today's economic paradigm to not only pay attention to their profits, but people and planet. And so what we preach out there is the triple bottom line is the three P's: people, planet, and profit, and in that order. And we actually have developed some software through the University of Carnegie Mellon to quantify that triple bottom line practice. And what that means is that we can actually show a commercial or business entity that if they actually invest in the planet and invest in people, their profits will actually grow. They actually have an ROI on triple bottom line.
ROI?
Practice. Yeah, return on investment. So that's what all those corporations want. They want a return on their investment. And if they've never really quantified investing into their own people, and this software actually helps us do that.
It seems that at this point in history, it's still a little bit counterintuitive to think that if you are doing good and not just exploiting people and exploiting the earth, which we certainly have a lot of, you will actually do better.
That's correct. That's correct. We've actually quantified. And one of the things that we do with that software is we show them, the main thing that these corporations are struggling with today with the Facebooks and the internet out there is employee production and then healthcare costs. Healthcare costs are at the forefront of most of these corporations. And, you know, with the Obamacare and the Affordable Healthcare Act, we're speaking to them on these terms that they really understand. And we've quantified, and through 10 years of research with PhD students at the University of Carnegie Mellon, compiling this data that shows, just a perfect example is LED lighting. Many people that work in an office space use fluorescent compact bulbs. We don't know that actually doesn't produce any blue light spectrum. But there's tons of white paper out there, and we've quantified that shows if you use LED lighting, which has a blue light spectrum, it reduces headaches. It increases employee production because they don't have this headache. They don't need to, take that break to go get the aspirin. It also produces the blue light spectrum, which then suppresses melatonin inside of our own bodies, which is why everybody gets that 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock crash in an office. You got to go get the coffee because you have no blue light spectrum suppressing the melatonin. And we've shown that LED lighting actually suppresses the melatonin, increases work production, and decreases healthcare costs.
And meanwhile, LED lighting is super energy efficient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Uses about 10% of the energy that a normal standard light bulb does with the same lumens.
So that's a beautiful example, and it's one probably relatively small example in the long run, but it sounds like there's a lot of these?
Absolutely. It goes all the way into air quality. It goes into air quality inside of a building using fresh air systems. It goes into ergonomics, ergonomics are when we look at the green wall, there's a study out there that shows inside of a hospital, they did a study of people looking at a brick wall and people looking out at nature, and how quickly they were able to get better. And the people that looked at a green forest got better by about 40% quicker. And so that in the hospital arena, if we can turn over those beds a little quicker, their healthcare costs go down. And so healthcare costs are all driven by the hospitals. That's what the insurances have to pay out. So if we can overall reduce those hospitals' expenses, then hopefully insurance rates will go down.
So what do? Airlift the hospital to a forest?
No. You just basically put greenery. It's very, very simple. Just put a couple of plants inside of a hospital, or design hospitals that face forests, paint murals. Even a mural is a very simple thing that can help people get better.
So one of the things that you're looking at is innovative ways of doing, for example, solar energy. And there is a technology where the solar panel works on both sides, the sides facing the sun and the side facing the roof.
Absolutely. What we've developed is a bifacial cell. And the reason we developed that bifacial cell is to utilize tax codes so that we could do that same thing, talk to the CFOs of major corporations and get those return on investments down. So those ROIs, you know, become from 7 years or a standard 10-year on a solar project down to 3 years. And what we do is we actually use a bifacial cell. And what that does is it collects energy from the top of the panel and it collects energy from the bottom of the panel. And the way that we're able to show the tax benefit is we're using the light that's bouncing off of the roof.
So it has to be a reflective roof.
Has to be a reflective roof. And you have to be able to buy the roof because that's the depreciation. So if you're in the market for a roof, and we can show you a 3-year payback on solar.
Now, there are some really interesting partnerships between companies and public institutions that are happening as a result of this type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. What we can show is a basic model that shows where a school system that we did in Pittsburgh, we had investors come in and purchase the roof. So the school system sold the investor the roof because we know that the main portion of renewable energies right now, the way you get the cost down is tax incentive. Well, the public sector doesn't have any tax burden. You know, they have no tax appetite. So what we can do is we can go into a school system or a public entity, a municipality, get an investor to purchase the roof. So that, and then we set it up on with solar, and then at the end of the 6 years, which the investor eats all of the tax appetite and gets a nominal return, but he knows it's a very safe investment because it's a municipality or a school that's been established for numerous years, and then what he does is he sells it to them for 25 cents on the dollar.
So what's in it for the company that invested in the roof?
Well, it's the tax appetite. When you go sell an investment to an investor and I have tax appetite in that investment.
What's tax appetite?
Tax appetite is tax liability. So if you're a person that makes a lot of money, you're paying the federal government a lot of money.
So basically it's a tax shelter. It's a write-off.
It's a write-off for them, a write-off investment for them.
Right. And so the school is happy because they get to use the solar. Is that correct?
Absolutely. They get solar for 25 cents on the dollar. And so it makes a very good return for them. Basically what happens is they sell the roof for 25 cents on the dollar and they get the solar for free.
And that can take up all or much of their energy cost.
Yes. You know, a school system or a school building is pretty spread out, and we can definitely maximize the solar on top of the roof.
We're talking to Jeremiah Clement of Infrastructure Innovations. There's a lot of acronyms in the work you do, which we have to explain to people. But what you were just talking about, the example with the solar, the highly efficient solar roof on the school, and the tax benefit for one person, the solar benefit for another person or another entity, comes through basically some Internal Revenue Service tax benefits and how they work.
Yes, and what that tax code is called is bonus depreciation. And so the way that we use that is you're going to depreciate the roof over 5 years instead of 39 and a half. And the way we were able to do that is we went out and got a PLR, which is a private letter ruling from the IRS. And basically we gave them our assembly, which is the roof and our bifacial cell, and we said that we prove that the roof is actually energy property. And so that's what allows us to depreciate the roof over 5 years instead of 39 and a half.
Energy property like a gas field?
Like a gas field, or you can bonus depreciate that, or wind, solar, geothermal, all of that is energy property.
So with solar, one of the problems that solar energy has had in being competitive and being one of the primary sources of energy in the United States is that we don't really have a level playing field.
No, we don't. And actually, what we've done is help jockey some legislation that would help level that playing field. And what that's called is an MLP, a Master Limited Partnership. Okay, and so what that is it's already used right now as an index that's traded on the stock market. And so right now it's only geared for fossil fuel-based projects, a gas plant in the middle of Kansas. You know, they used them for coal plants back in the day. They don't use them anymore for that, but they use them for the pipeline. The Keystone XLT is actually an MLP. You can actually invest in that pipeline. And all we're asking is to level the playing field. If they just added three words to that legislation that added renewable energies, which would be, you know, biomass, solar, wind, geothermal, it would level the playing field and allow us to go raise the monies that we need to start solar fields, and then that's going to drive the cost of solar panels down for the end consumer, the residential side of it, because now the volume has come up.
So the MLP, Master Limited Partnerships, how do they work? What are they?
It's just a partnership that has a partnership tax code, so it's taxed as a partnership corporation, but it's traded like a public stock on the NASDAQ, or you know, you could choose the NYMEX or the NASDAQ or Dow, wherever they decide to place that, and then lots of monies then flood into that because now it's an investment that's traded to the public entities, and you'll get money from mutual funds, different bank investments, and then the standard, you know, consumer out there can now invest in renewable energy products.
As it is right now, they can only do that for fossil fuel projects.
Right, through an MLP.
How did it get written that way?
In 1960. We just didn't, that's how old the legislation is. It was written in 1960, and we really didn't know about renewable energies, and it's been brought forward a couple of times now, but now Senator Coons out of Delaware is really jockeying at home, and we need the people of New Mexico to call their federal senator or their House representative to help him jockey that through. It's in the House right now.
So it's actual legislation that is up for consideration.
It doesn't have a House bill just yet, but it has tons of support from business, local communities, labor communities. Obviously, the environmentalists love it because that's going to help fund renewable energy projects that are ultimately going to help put out coal and gas plants.
And that ultimately is the goal of a lot of what you're working on, is to put an end to coal extraction and coal burning, because that is one of the greatest contributors to climate change.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about wind technology. Not only is wind energy something that is, shall we say, not brand new. I mean, you can tell us sort of where the industry is at right now, but there are also some innovations in wind technology that are going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. T. Boone Pickens had a TED Talk about why he invested in so much wind and why he lost so much money in wind. And what we did is what we took away from that talk was there's two major problems in wind energy today. You see those big turbines as you drive, you know, wherever in the state of New Mexico, and we have them all over the Midwest. Those big turbines are very costly for maintenance-wise, and then they take 11 miles an hour of wind to get them turning. So the cut-in speed is a problem, and the maintenance is an issue. So what we did is we looked at that industry, and what we did is we developed a wind technology that reduces the maintenance cost by about 50%, and it takes the cut-in speed down to 2 miles an hour.
So if the wind is blowing at 2 miles an hour, you're producing energy, albeit perhaps less energy.
Well, actually, we're producing almost the same amount of energy at the 10-mile-an-hour speed that the big turbines produce, because what we're able to do is use what's called a venturi system. So what we're doing is we're harvesting the wind. We put two funnels up in the air, and we bring the wind down to the ground. That's how we reduce the maintenance cost, because now you're using, instead of a lift to get up 90 feet in the air to work on a big turbine, we're using smaller turbines, and it's right on the ground. And then what we're able to do is we're able to venturi that air down, so we're squeezing that air down, increasing the velocity, and what we found through our testing is we can actually put numerous turbines behind each other in the same tunnel and extract more and more energy out of that.
Can you say more about that? You're taking air from way up high and bringing it way down low?
Yeah, I mean, one of the projects that we're doing right now is in Aventura, Florida. It's our first building integrated project, and what we're doing is we're already 350 feet up in the air, so you don't need to bring it all the way down to the ground, but we're doing it right on the roof. And so what we're doing is we're harvesting that energy, that wind, right up there on the roof, and we're venturing it. So we're just basically squeezing that air down. If you look at a standard plane engine, you see a little knob above the engine, and then there's the engine capacity right behind it. What that's doing is it's venturing that air over the knob, and it's squeezing so you get the maximum amount of power out of the wind velocity.
One of the things about wind energy, and I can't really speak firsthand to the merits of this argument, but there are some people who are complaining about wind turbines because they're so loud. If you bring that energy down to the roof or down to the ground, is it really noisy?
No, actually, we solved that noise problem. Our inventor actually is a vibration specialist. And so what he did is he actually soundproofed our tubes. So instead of, and it goes into, we put our technology to test with the EPA, because the EPA is the one that set the standard for 80 acres per 1 megawatt of turbine. So that's why you see, they need 80 acres of space for one turbine. And the reason is is that sound vibration issue. It's vibrations that we hear, and so you know, a lot of animals, and the EPA says that animals are scared of it, and it does push critters away from it. It's got that high pitched sound. So what we did is we actually went ahead and soundproofed our tubes so that right inside of right on top of a building, you won't even be able to hear it. And we're using much smaller turbines so that it's easier to work on. They're very easy to replace, and it reduces the sound as well.
It seems like there's a lot going on rooftops these days.
Yeah, there really is. You know, we have our wind technology, but we also have some technology that helps urban grow gardens. And so what we're doing is there's a big flight to, you know, urban gardening. And so what we've developed is some technology that uses SIP panels with PV that's on top of it.
Wait, SIP, PV, here we go with our acronyms.
SIP is a styrofoam insulated panel used in a lot of construction applications, and PV is our photovoltaic. And so what we've done is we've wrapped that around and we've created a greenhouse on top of a roof, and we use LED lighting inside of it so that we can grow year-round. We can grow a little bit more efficiently with LED lighting because you can gear the lighting spectrum around what you're growing, but it also collects its own rainwater, so it's totally self-sufficient. The PV creates enough electricity to run the LED lights inside. It captures its own rainwater, and we use vertical grow gardening to maximize the opportunity.
What is vertical grow gardening?
Vertical grow gardening is being developed in, one of the major companies in America right now is called Gotham Greens. They're out of New York. They're the leader in vertical grow gardening, and what that means is that you can grow inside of a 10-foot high space. You're going to grow maybe 5 to 6 different rows of vegetables going up instead of just out. The standard greenhouse just wants to go out. You know, you just have that one level. And so vertical grow gardening using LED light technology allows us to go up as well.
And so that's why you need lighting besides natural lighting, because you've got what amount to multiple stories of a building in which plants are growing.
Absolutely.
Now, I'd heard of things like that, and what I always wondered was, I mean, there's nature in which all kinds of synergies happen. There are microbes in the soil, there are bees and birds and pollinators, there is rainwater and everything that falls from it, there's groundwater, there's all kinds of interactions going. Can you replicate those inside of a building?
Yeah, absolutely, you can. You definitely have some limitations inside of a garden or a greenhouse, but horticulturists have done cross-pollination inside of greenhouses for years.
How do they do that?
I'm not a horticulture expert, so I'm not exactly sure, but I support the technology that helps them do what they do.
So when you talk about urban gardening in New York City in a multiple-story building, what kind of scale are we talking about? And I wonder also if it's economically feasible, considering that, I mean, that's prime real estate. Somebody could live in it.
Yeah, somebody could live in it or an office space. Right now there's a flight from big cities to suburb areas for big corporations. Tax incentives, all kinds of things play into effect. But down in the city of Chicago, we almost have a crisis on our hands where we have about 40% vacancy rate in office space. So there's tons of commercial space that's out there. And so we're going to utilize this space more effectively because the average class A office space downtown Chicago, which is the high-end stuff, is about $35 a foot. And we can actually produce enough vegetables to gain about $350 a foot.
No way.
Yeah, absolutely. In the city of Chicago, we have a huge problem that all of our vegetables in the middle of the winter are coming from Mexico. So the transportation storage costs are astronomical. We can't grow anything in Chicago in the middle of winter. So this is actually going to be a huge benefit using the same pricing model that they have right now from Mexico. Our carbon reduction is going to be astronomical just because the storage is going to be so significantly less, and there's no transportation because you're going to be harvesting and shipping it less than 4 or 5 blocks away.
This is very interesting. So you're going to have office buildings in downtown Chicago, and on the 4th story is an insurance company, and on the 5th story is a tomato plantation.
That's correct. That's correct.
And on the sixth story is the restaurant that uses the tomatoes.
Absolutely,
I hope.
Or the ground floor, or the 95th story of the Hancock would love organic tomatoes that are picked that day. I mean, restaurants in Chicago are pretty famous, and they'll pay a premium for something that's picked in less than a day.
Is this already happening?
Absolutely, absolutely. We're entering into right now with an agreement, a produce buy agreement with Fresh Markets. They're based in Chicago, and we're putting together our business plan. We've already proven our technology, and so now what we're going to do is we're going to enter into an agreement, so they're going to start buying vegetables, and that's the one that you need. You need a grocery store to start doing it, and then you could just grow it from there to restaurants and other purveyors.
So, ladies and gentlemen, when on some floor of an office building in Chicago they actually start doing this, we will let you know.
Absolutely.
We're talking to Jeremiah Clement of Infrastructure Innovations. What we've been talking about so far is more about commercial spaces than residential spaces. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. For the public sector, or the residential sector, I should say, for us to drive renewables into that sector, we really need the commercial entities to jump on board so we can drive that price down. So the volume needs to come up for these types of technologies, and then that way the residential space will be able to afford it.
What kinds of innovations in solar? Well, you mentioned the bifacial solar panels, but what is going to allow solar to be truly affordable for residential customers?
It really is volume. It really is volume. If we can get that MLP passed through the legislation that levels the playing field, and then now we start producing these huge solar farms, which we've already got tons of land already dedicated to some solar farms, and we're just waiting on these MLPs to come through so that we can get the funds necessary to buy huge bulks of solar from around the world. Germany is one of the main producers of solar. Obviously, China's going to help in that market and drive that price down. As the demand becomes more, the supply will then increase, and then it will drive that price down.
Let's talk for a moment about the United States and China. China has seen an opportunity and is developing solar technology like nobody's business. Does the U.S. have a fighting chance in the solar market?
Yeah, absolutely. We're getting into some more public policy here, and we'll see how the United States determines how they're going to start treating some of the imports from China. But we definitely do have a chance, and it really needs to be driven by that supply and demand. And once we can really grab a hold of some big projects, there's the solar company that we work with is Prism, and they're based out of Phoenix, and they are absolutely ready to build more manufacturing plants right there in Arizona.
If you get this MLP, Master Limited Partnership legislation passed, that will then allow any energy company, not just fossil fuel energy companies, to take advantage of these limited partnerships. Okay, we're talking about wind and solar. What other alternative energy technologies could take advantage of this, and what would that look like?
Yeah, geothermal. Geothermal is a technology that we work with right now, and we have some cutting-edge geothermal technology. We use CO2 as our refrigerant and as our liquid. And so what that allows us to do is be much more energy efficient than the standard geothermal system out there, but it also helps with EPA regulations because EPA has some very strict regulations on putting glycol in our systems, which is needed to make sure that it doesn't freeze up, that it that it stays lubricated. But by using CO2 in a liquid state, we don't need any of that glycol in it. CO2 is in our atmosphere.
Yes, in fact, we'd like to put it to some good use.
Absolutely.
What about hydroelectric? What about biomass?
All those projects would be allowed to participate in MLPs, and biomass would be the next step, too, for that MLP arena because, we have all this dead-standing beetle kill that's just rotting away. The USDA came out.
Beetle kill meaning, for example, forests in New Mexico, in particular in Colorado.
And Montana and the BC. I mean, it goes all the way up. I mean, beetle kill's a big epidemic.
Where bark beetles have just essentially decimated the forests.
Absolutely. And the USDA came out and said that for the first time in U.S. history, our forests are a negative carbon impact right now.
What does that mean?
Basically, it's producing more CO2 than it's taking out of the atmosphere.
Because those trees are rotting and giving off CO2.
That's correct. They're just dead standing there. And we're not harvesting them because there's, you know, some organizations out there that don't think that that's the right thing to do. We should just let them, you know, fall over and decompose naturally. And we're saying that that's giving a negative impact into the atmosphere. And so we're saying, let us go and harvest those out. Let's make it into electricity. And that's where the biomass would really come into play.
And so you're still producing CO2, but at least you're getting some energy out of it.
Right. At least you're getting, there's some environmental impact out of it. And if we can put a coal plant out of business by using a biomass project, then, you know, the CO2 impact is actually a positive.
Is it really at that scale of putting a coal plant out of business?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so much dead-standing beetle killed that the USDA is feverishly trying to put together these biomass projects, and they have one in Fort Collins right now that just got assembled at the University of Colorado State.
I think one of the things that is so tricky when you're at a kind of creative and innovative stage and where that creation and innovation is so urgently necessary is, okay, somebody, Gotham Gardens or whatever, does a project and it's great, but then how do you get other people to do it, or how do you make it easy for other people to do it?
You show them. I mean, it's education-based, you know, getting into the university systems, you know, getting into the south side of Chicago and showing these kids that, you know, there's other ways to make money. And at $350 a foot, we would be beating out some insurance companies in the Sears Tower. And if you could just show them and get into the education side of it, that's the formula that we need.
And then architects will come forward who know how to do this. Companies that build these buildings will proliferate, and pretty soon you've got urban vertical gardens in every city in the country.
Absolutely, and we need those architects to come forward. We need those engineers to come forward, and we just need to dive into the university system itself. And we have some innovators down at the University of Carnegie Mellon that are already helping us with some projects, but we need, you know, to get the word out there.
It's interesting, too, because, again, a lot of these things are about scale. And when we talk about the kind of problems that we're facing in the United States, it's not only about climate change. It's about things like the obesity epidemic, which we've talked about recently on this show. And if you were talking about doing urban gardening that produces a large enough scale of vegetables and fruits and lettuce and things like that to have an impact on that city's diet, you're also talking about lowering healthcare costs.
Absolutely. The easiest way, I have two small children, and how I got them to eat vegetables is I have them go to the grocery store with me and pick the vegetables out. And, you know, you educate people on what these vegetables are, and now they're participating in growing them, and they're participating in harvesting them, and that's what's going to get people to start transforming from the Cheetos and the Doritos over to a mixed salad and a couple of tomatoes.
We're talking to Jeremiah Clement of Infrastructure Innovations. Yet another project that you're working on is yet another acronym, CLT, cross-laminated timber. What is that?
Cross-laminated timber is a way to produce wall sections. We're mostly familiar already with cross-laminated timber in the glulam beam business. So most of us
have seen
glulam beams. We've seen these beams, wood beams that are stacked, you know, pieces of wood that are stacked on top of each other. We've all seen those beams that are, they look really nice. They're very strong. They're about 200% stronger than steel, pound for pound. The environmental impact of CLT is about 80% less than that of steel. And one of the things that we're interested in cross-laminated timber is that you can kind of peek behind the curtain and look at Europe. Europe last year alone produced 400 million board feet of CLT. In the United States, we produce zero.
When we use that here, we're using CLT imported from Europe?
We don't use any CLT here.
Oh, okay.
We're not hip to it yet. In our business model, what we try to show is why the benefits are there for CLT. One of the major problems in the United States for us to jump into the CLT industry was that here in the United States, we don't really harvest the wood properly enough. We don't cut the wood precisely enough. We don't dry it precisely enough. This is a very precise process that needs to be very detail-oriented, and the sawmills just aren't set up for that here in the United States. And so we saw our opportunity when an Austrian sawmill decided to come into North Florida. There was a lot of incentives for them to come in through the through Florida, and we partnered with them, and we've bought land next to them, and now we have that true partner that can produce the wood and the moisture content that we need and the precision specs that we need, and now we can really start talking to developers about putting CLT instead of steel or traditional stick build. A traditional stick build house in the Midwest takes about 2 weeks to build, and we can put the wall sections up in a day. And so when you're talking about time for dollars, we can save a lot of time, and that saves money. And so now when you start talking to developers about building 300 houses and how much time could I save them in this process, it becomes astronomical. And we've gotten a huge corporation down in Florida called Lennar Homes already very, very interested in CLT for the residential market, just for the time saving and the waste saving, because now we're going to manufacture these wall sections through our facility. They're run through CNC machines, which
through
are
what?
CNC machines.
What's that?
It's a machine that uses computer calibration to cut out wall sections, to cut out window sections, door sections, even route out where the electricity or plumbing might go if it's needed in the wall cavity. But we'd like to design without any electricity in the outside walls, to design it using floor electricity runs. And so you use a lot less waste, and you can put up your house in a day.
So you're talking about basically doing away with framing and sheetrock?
We wouldn't really do away with the sheetrock. You're still going to want to finish the inside of your walls, probably. You know, most people aren't going to want to look at all wood inside. You know, we hope that they would leave one wall section, and we would do a finished wall section with CLT because it does look beautiful. It's very nice to look at wood. But you're not going to do away with sheetrock, but you are going to do away with the framing part of it.
What kind of wood does it use?
It uses Doug fir or pine. Either one is a great sustainable wood. Another one that we're looking into right now is bamboo, which is a very fast growing. The most sustainable wood out there is bamboo.
Right. And bamboo is one of those things. It's sustainable. It became a fad. Everybody wanted to have their eco house with bamboo. And then somebody started clearing forest to put in bamboo, so it became this anti-environmental thing. And like so many of these things, it becomes kind of double-edged.
It does. And you have to be mindful of whatever you're doing, and being mindful of the ecosystem itself, and looking at the avenues that are most sustainable.
The company that you work with is called Infrastructure Innovations. What exactly do they do? What are they?
We really are a consulting firm. We've gone out and invested in some of these technologies that we've been talking about here today, but we really are a consulting firm. We bring people together. We bring corporations together with technologies. We own part of the wind technology that I was talking about. We own part of the solar technology that I was talking about. We own part of the geothermal technology that I was talking about. You know, it's a collection of people that have been in solar, been in sustainability for almost 50 years.
And the people whom you work with who are actually implementing some of these technologies are presumably saving a lot of energy.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Some of our clients are saving well upwards of 50% on their energy costs. We're actually saving a grocery store in the Pittsburgh area 90% of their energy costs.
In that particular case, how are you doing it?
Through solar, through our solar program. We go in and we make them efficient first, and then we maximize the solar opportunity. So what we did is we used a geothermal heat exchanger for their chiller system. We used LED lighting inside of the facility. We did motion sensors on all the LED lighting, and then we put an array of about 25 kW on top of their roof.
That's an investment that pays off in how much time?
For them, it paid off in about 3 years.
Quite amazing. So it's basically something that anybody would do if they knew about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have not had one major CFO tell me no.
CFO, Chief Financial Officer.
Yeah, sorry. I keep using those acronyms.
It's okay. I'm good at the end. I'm going to line them all up.
All right.
No, I'm just kidding. So when somebody, a supermarket, say, saves 90% or 80% or whatever of their energy costs, do they then get direct tax benefit or some kind of benefit for doing that besides just the cost savings?
No, when I talk about cost savings, I'm talking about all those tax benefits rolled into one. So when I say a 3-year return on investment, that includes energy consumption savings, that includes tax incentives and tax depreciation.
And are they getting what's known as carbon credits?
What we do is we advise most of our clients to use those carbon credits and bank them, not use them, bank them. We do believe that there's going to be a carbon tax in the very near future. Most of the corporations that we talk to also believe that there's going to be a carbon tax, and those carbon credits are going to be worth their weight in gold in the coming future. So we say don't use them right now, bank them, and we show them how to put them down on their balance sheet.
We're talking to Jeremiah Clement of Infrastructure Innovations, and what you're talking about is really a kind of paradigm shifting, but also staying within the business climate and the rules that we have, but also making huge changes that boil down to the way we live.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Our triple bottom line software really is going to be an economic paradigm shift. Now, there are corporations out there already practicing triple bottom line in Europe. Getting the United States to come on board with that will be a huge shift in how we do stuff.
What does it look like in Europe?
Well, in Europe, you know, 1996, for example, Deutsche Bank, which is a huge bank, I have a couple friends that work there, they went to a triple bottom line theory. Their employee production is much better. Their healthcare costs aren't what our healthcare costs are here. And we can look right here in the United States at triple bottom line. And what that means is we're putting the people, planet, and profit in that order first. And so if you look at Google and how Google operates, they put their people first. Their people work so much for them. They get maximum production out of every single employee because of Googleplex. You know, you go to a Googleplex. I got to tour it about 2 years ago. They've got massage therapists. They've got everything that they need there for a healthy lifestyle. And they use mindfulness inside of that Googleplex. And it really does show where Google's been.
I've always wondered, when you have a company like that, do people who work there get kind of disengaged to the reality that the rest of the world isn't like that at all?
You kind of do, but that's where our heart is at, and that's why we're trying to transform all the other corporations to follow along. Because I can show a corporation today how the triple bottom line will actually increase their profits and not decrease by the investment in the people and the planet. And that's the astronomical part, that's the game-changing paradigm shift of economies that we're trying to do.
Are you getting pushback from any direction?
I wouldn't say pushback. I would say it's an education process. You know, it's definitely a practice philosophy that would have to change from the corporation topside down. You know, and you know, getting corporations to buy into 10 years of analytical data that shows them that they are going to reap the benefits of investing in their people and in the planet. It really does just ring true to them.
What about from fossil fuel companies?
Well, you know, we're definitely going to get pushback from them. You know, they're pretty much the only people that are pushing back on the MLP legislation that's in right now. You know, we have talked to FPNL, which is Florida Light and Power, down in Florida. They're a major utility player here in the United States, and they are receptive to investing in people and planet, which is kind of a game changer in the utility space.
I'm thinking about a place like New Mexico. Let's say we were able to really innovate and make New Mexico into a place where everybody was using solar to get their energy or a large portion of their energy, and wind, in which we were providing utility-scale solar, and oil and gas just became uncompetitive, and therefore we were no longer having so much extraction. That's where our tax base is in this state. Is there, as part of this paradigm, a way to replace that kind of tax base with a renewable energy tax base?
Well, let's talk about why I'm here in Santa Fe. because, you know, the system as it is, and I think most people can agree that the system is broken. You know, we say we're dependent on that for a tax base. There's something wrong with that. There's spillage everywhere in government, and, you know, that's one of the things that rings true to my heart and why I came here to New Mexico, is to visit with a good friend of mine, Merle Lefkoff, and her Center for Emergent Diplomacy.
The fabulous Merle Lefkoff, who's been on this show numbers of times.
Awesome.
Yeah.
She is just the greatest lady in the world, and her Center for Emergent Diplomacy actually has a project right now that is called Bretton Woods 3.0. And what that is looking at is an economic paradigm shift. We know that the economics and the way that the system works today is not sustainable. It is broken. The congressmen out there are bought by a lobbying system that is just absolutely broken. That needs to be fixed from the ground up.
How are you thinking about doing that?
Well, what we're doing with Merle's Center for Emergent Diplomacy is we have a project right now called Bretton Woods 3.0, and we want to bring a conference together in 2016, the summer of 2016, that brings 730 delegates together, just like back in 1944 when they changed and produced the way economy works today. In 1944, they all went to Bretton Woods. They decided how the IMF was going to run, the World Bank was going to run, and they created our economics that we live in today that's broken.
And so what are some of the ideas for, I mean, it's always this question, there are people who have a kind of emotional penchant for revolution. We're like, let's break the whole thing and make a new one. And people who don't so much say, well, how can we reform it and transform it and let go of things one at a time and make a new system and so on. What are you specifically thinking about?
Well, complexity science is the basic fundamental that we would use to produce ideas that would come out of this conference. So using those ideas that would come, you know, these 730 people, I don't have all of the answers on how a new economy would look, but these 730 delegates, these people that we would have come to this conference, would come up with the ideas and the structure and how we would come out of this economy that we're in right now and create a new economy that has equality in it, has, you know, a sustainability factor to it, and that triple bottom line theory is practiced throughout the country and throughout the world.
I think one of the things that interests me is how to have an economic system and political democracy simultaneously. We seem to have a kind of tension between capitalism on the one hand and democracy on the other.
Yeah, we do here in the United States, and I think it's lost in translation, and I'm showing that around the world by bridging that gap into the renewable energy sector and showing them that the triple bottom line economics plays right into capitalism, you know, and the profits are there. So it's really just lost in translation. You know, people get so one-sided to the two-party dictatorship that we have in this country, and the new ideas aren't coming forward because we're funneled into or pigeonholed into this idea that we're conservative or we're a liberal or we're a Republican or we're a Democrat. And that system itself is broken. And
or we're pro-business or pro-environment.
Right. And we can be both. I'm pro-business and pro-environment. And I'm proving it around the country, and I'm getting corporations to be both and to keep investing in their people, to keep investing in the planet through a sustainable business practice and renewable energies.
So you're here to talk about making this Bretton Woods conference happen. You're from Chicago. Really different world here in New Mexico.
Absolutely. Looking around here in New Mexico, I kind of salivate at the idea of renewable energies. I see all of these flat roofs. I see all of this sun. There hasn't been a cloud in the sky since I've been here in the last week.
Which, of course, people from outside think, oh, that's nice weather. We think this is horrifying. We haven't had any precipitation since December.
Yes, Merle is not happy that there hasn't been a cloud, but I look at the sky, I look at these flat roofs, and I look at you know, the dependency on coal, on the coal plant here in New Mexico, and I say we can easily transform New Mexico, Santa Fe, Albuquerque into a renewable energy space very simply.
And, of course, the huge amounts of open land and public land.
Yeah, and, you know, big solar fields, you know, we could be exporting. You know, you were talking about our tax dependency on the oil and fossil fuel industry, oil and gas, and, you know, we have huge amounts of public land that we could be selling California, Arizona, and Colorado that energy from big, huge solar fields. I mean, it's a prime ground for producing renewable energy.
It's not often that I speak to somebody who is really hopeful and optimistic about the future of this country and this planet and has any data whatsoever to back it up.
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot. I get a lot of people that come away with conversations with me that have a little more hope. I know that the solutions are out there. I do see young people surrounding these renewable energy products and ideas. I see out there bridging that gap to those corporations and speaking their language and pushing basically my propaganda of renewable energy in a much more sustainable economic paradigm and atmosphere or economy. We've done it. You know, we've bridged that gap. And so, yeah, even the most ultra conservative people come away saying, you know, we're ready to do renewable. We're ready to go efficient.
And it'll be interesting to see what kind of cultural changes result from that and whether we can kind of get past the sort of, you know, semi-Fox News-generated polarization that really has plagued our country.
Absolutely. It's just, proof is in the pudding, my grandfather always said. And as these projects start springing up everywhere, people are going to see that solar works. You can't, you know, I still have certain people. I was in a board meeting in Florida just last week, and he said, solar doesn't work. It's a 21-year payback. Well, I looked at him, and I said, you know, those are two different statements. You're saying that solar doesn't work, and it's a 21-year payback. That means it must be producing energy. And he stopped dead in his tracks, and he said, okay, let me hear what you have to say. And so, you know, it's defining, it's the lost in translation. Let's define what you're saying here. You know, you're saying solar doesn't work. Well, it does work. It produces energy. You're saying it's too far of a payback. Well, now I'm showing you that it's a 3-year payback, not a 21-year payback. So now I'm bridging that gap in the conversation. I'm mending those lost in translation conversations.
Jeremiah Clement is an energy efficiency consultant for Infrastructure Innovations. They're on the web at infrastructureinnovations.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.